Thank you again for joining me on another episode of Made to Gast. Today we have, from Tradewell Decoys, Ryan Gast. Thank you very much for joining me today, my friend.
Thank you. It's an honor, actually, to be here. I've watched a few of your episodes, and the people that you have on there, it's quite a list. So I feel really honored to be part of that.
I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate what you do. I appreciate it from an art aspect, and the reason I say from an art aspect is because I really can honestly say I know zero about like the sport of spearfishing. I don't know anything about it. I've been, since we've discussed this, I've been looking at my local, because I'm not a huge ice fisher. I've been very vocal of that. Like I'm sure there's a trip or the person to take me for the best experience possible. I'd love to try that to see if it enhances my experience. But what you build for, which I'd like you to get into, that intrigues me. So I looked into my local laws, and they're so blurry on up here in Ontario, what I can actually do. Because most of them are talking about a spear gun.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are not using spear guns.
No, we're using, a long metal spear that has usually somewhere between 5 to 9 tines. It's trying to think of what it would be like, but
a trident's 3 points, but like a giant, exactly. Like it's something out of Gladiator. Yeah. That's what I remember it from.
Yeah.
But it's a large, like you said, it's a large fork, bunch of tines with points on them, and you're hand throwing those, like, or you're just shooting them, yeah, like pushing them into the water type of thing. So, yeah. But yeah, I've looked at my local laws, and it's like, you can't have a spear gun within 30 meters of water's edge, but that doesn't say like it has to be in shore. I don't know if that means like you have to be 30 feet or 30 meters into a body of water away from shore. Like it's so mm-hmm. great. So I'm going to look into some, because that's something that I would definitely love to try. Yeah. Literally you don't talk to, I can't talk to anybody about it here. Nobody does it. Everyone no. that you bring it up to just says you're not allowed to have spear guns.
Right.
So yeah,
I've always understood that Canada doesn't allow spearing, from what I've looked into.
Right.
And it's kind of a controversial sport down here in some states, even in our own state at times. So, and we can get into that, but, it's a different type of fishing. It's more like hunting.
Yes.
Which a lot of people that bow hunt, say it's exactly like bow hunting for deer.
Which is what I mean, many moons ago I used to do or attempt to do was, I bow hunted. And that's what intrigues me about it, is it's not, you have one, you know what, for someone who doesn't know what they're talking about, I shouldn't explain what it is. Maybe you can explain exactly what spear fishing, I guess, ice spear fishing. What would the classic name be for what you do?
Or we call what it you dark build house for? Fishing, and the reason Perfect. For that is because we sit in a fish house or a shelter. It doesn't have any windows. It's as black as you can get it. The blacker, the better. The darker, the better in there. Because when you shut that door, the darker it is, the better you can see in the water. It's almost like walking into a high-vis, high-definition TV if the water's clear. And that is what I think the first time people spear is like. It's almost like, it's just so amazing to see under the ice.
Right.
And that's really kind of what gets people, I think, is you can see the fish that you're catching or spearing. You know, a lot of people sight angle even in their spear house. But, and then the other thing too about being dark is fish can see. I always say it's a lot like being on stage. The lights are on you. You can't see into the crowd.
Okay.
But if someone has a bright light in that crowd, you might be able to pick it up. And so if there's right. any windows or any light that comes in, those fish can sometimes see a shadow or whatever. So
And you're just trying to remove any spooking of the fish. You're just trying to be.
Yep. It's not as easy as it may sound. You know, they come into the, we make decoys, and that's kind of what I do. It's an attracted, it's like a fishing lure. It swims in circles instead of, you know, I make them to do a whole bunch of different things, but the classic fish decoys, you pull on a string, it comes up and it swims in a circle downward. Mm. And an injured fish is kind of what you're shooting for.
Right.
Sometimes you don't want to touch the decoy at all. You just sit it down there, like especially later in the winter when the fish start to get really sluggish. They don't like movement at all. You touch the decoy, they might even leave.
Right.
But early on, now, like right now, if I can get a fish house out today or tomorrow, they're pretty active. And a lot of times you're really moving the decoy down there to get them to come in.
Now, it's not like from, like I said, traditionally what I know from ice fishing where you're augering out a 4 or 6 inch hole. You guys are cutting out a large window into the ice.
Yes. Now, and there's no restriction in our state how big the hole can be. So you can buy a pop-up fish house and you can cut that hole as big as you want in there. And there's some people that do that.
Right.
We have, you know, I bring an ice auger out later in winter. Right now I could probably chisel a hole open. But, you know, you were talking like 2 by 3 feet average. Some people have a 3 by 3 foot hole. But we usually drill a hole or two. And then I have a buddy actually that owns an ice saw business. And it's a big blue blade. You might have seen him on YouTube videos, but he just lives a few miles away from me. And we use an ice saw to kind of connect the dots. And then it's really easy to cut a hole that way. And some people just auger holes all the way around and then they chip it open. But
right
later in the season, it's challenging. You're dealing with most of the time 2 to 3, sometimes 3 feet of ice that you need to move. And that really keeps a lot of people from doing it. Mm-hmm. Right now it's really easy to cut a hole. But yeah, that ice in like February is, if you can find a good spot and stay there and keep your hole open, that's what people do.
So that's what I was going to say. Generally speaking, we're ice fishing. You can basically traverse a lake, and put in 1,000 holes. Yeah. For dark house fishing, you're generally going to do maybe 1 or 2 holes a season, and that's going to be your shop. Like you're going to set up there.
I would say that I probably average. I do a lot of fishing on other lakes too, but if the fishing's not good, I'll move my house as many times as I need to. Maybe not in a day. But I would say I would average 20 to 30 holes for sure, easily.
Oh, wow.
You get pretty proficient at it when you have the right tools.
Makes sense.
It's not fun. Like I said, in February, I probably don't cut many holes. And in North Dakota, you can fish until the middle of March. And a lot of times you are dealing with 3 feet ice. And so it's a workout. You got to be in shape to do it. And so, you know, some of the older people that do this sport, you know, we've always been like, if you need someone to cut a hole for you, just let us know. Right. Because
like a real tight community like that.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And I mean, like, and I get that with the ice. And I know up in Northern Ontario where I'm at in Canada, I mean, I know guys that ice fish and they'll put 2 extensions on augers just to get to the water. Like you're dealing with like 8 to 10 feet of ice in some places, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
At that point you just put the ice rods away. Like, I
don't think I would do it with that.
but that's what intrigues me. Sorry. What we were talking about. That's what intrigues me about what you do. And I've watched like your decoys be made because you said that they have a specific build to them, like a lure. Each lure I make has a different like movement or feel to it. And that's what intrigues me about what you do, because you're not like, it's not a cast and retrieve. It's a raise and lower. And what your action needs to be is on a vertical column as opposed to a horizontal column.
Right.
Which really intrigues me because you make these beautiful pieces of art, but they have to function in a different way than what traditionally I would be focusing in on. So what, maybe you can tell me how, because it, to me, it's very unique. Now it might be more prevalent down where you are, but what got you into, what's the beginning stories of you starting to get into the whole decoy scene, making decoys, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Pursuing this passion.
I've been spearing since, I think my dad first took me out when I was 12. And we went to a lake, about an hour away from here, and I got to spear with my grandpa, and, that's who I named my decoys after. But, I speared with him that day, and he ended up dying a few days later. But my grandpa,
wow,
it was my mom's dad, and he got my dad into spearing. And then, so when he passed away, my dad got some of his equipment, and, my dad started spearing then a little bit more often. He'd take me out, and we didn't use decoys a lot when I was growing up, in this area of Minnesota. You go down to central Minnesota, decoys are a big deal, but up in the northern part, a lot of guys use daredevils that spin on a motor. So you have a box motor that runs on like a lantern battery, and it spins in circles down there, and then you can give it a jig every once in a while, and it'll do one of those flashes down there.
Okay.
We did use decoys from time to time, but my dad passed away almost 22 years ago, and when he passed away, I'm his only son, and I have three sisters, but we were very close, very, very close. We went hunting and fishing, and he's just a great guy. And I became very anxious. And a coworker gave me a decoy at work that her husband had made for me. And I was sat there looking at it, and I thought, you know what? I want to start doing something with my hands to kind of keep my mind off of just losing my dad, and just giving me something to do in the off season for spearing, because it's only about a three month season.
Okay.
And so I sat down and I found a video on PBS, which is our public television down here.
Yeah, yeah.
And a guy was showing step by step how to make a decoy. So I slowly started getting some of the tools to do that. And it took me a good year just to figure out what I needed. Nobody taught me other than that. And I'm not much of a carver. I mean, I wasn't. I liked to draw. That was kind of my outlet for any kind of art back then.
Right.
And I started making them and kind of got to where I felt comfortable. The only problem was I learned real quick how important the type of wood you use. I started using basswood, and I wasn't sealing it good enough, and so I'd throw a decoy down the hole, and it would pretty much explode. You know, the paint would come off, and it would soak up the water.
Right,
it'd swell up. And it was so frustrating, because I'd spent all this time, and I almost quit. I was like, I can't figure this out. Well, then I talked to the guy that had made that video. I just emailed him, and I said, what's my problem? And he said, try using cedar or pine or something else, and I started using cedar. And then from there on, that's kind of what I've been using. But yeah, my father passing away was kind of the start of it. And then through the years, I've just, it got into my blood, and now I just, it's what I want to do in my free time.
Right.
I want to try different things. I want to make them better. You know, every year I would try to do something a little better with them.
First of all, working with some different woods, I know that cedar's not always the nicest, because you can get it very smooth. You can get it very but as far as like hucking pieces off, it is a dense wood to move. So like, that's a challenge all on its own, but like, you have these beautiful pieces of art that have, like I said, have a purpose, but like, to get it honed in there, you can see that there's been so much time in development, in practicing your skills. Like you're like, oh, you know, I do art, but I wasn't much of a carver back then. But you can see how much like focus and discipline has been put into what you do, because I see these, and they're beautiful. They're beautiful works of art. Tradewell Decoys on Instagram. Make sure you go take a look at what he's doing. And like I said, with cedar's a tough wood to work with. I mean, it's a big wood in like musky baits and stuff like that up here. A lot of people use cedars, but it's a lot of their carvings are like, a lot of musky baits are simplistic in style.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're beautiful, they function, but they're not hyper detailed, because to carve those hyper details is very, very difficult. Now I look at some of your stuff and you got some beautiful gills carved in. Like you got so much work that put into it, and you can see the time that's put into it, which is a testament to what you've just said and how much time you put into it. The other thing you said, that I just had this conversation a couple days ago, people were talking, I can't even remember what the emphasis of the conversation was, but you were saying, well, I mean, I was talking with this group, I said, like, regardless if I stop selling my baits today,
mm-hmm.
this isn't about necessarily me selling baits.
No.
I would be doing this in my basement by myself. I just don't have any more room in my tackle box anymore. Like, now I'm doing it for other people. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is something that I would do, building lures, regardless if I had 100 followers or 10,000 followers, or if I sold one lure or didn't sell any. The building and it's for anybody that doesn't do it, for a maker, like, I mean, I'm taking it from the way you're speaking as well, and myself, is that it's cathartic more than it is about the sale. It's the sitting down and letting your mind shut off. There's so many things to be anxious about, and we have found something that we can sit down, we can keep our hands busy, we can kind of tune everything out, and we can explore our creative minds without outside impacts affecting what we do. So I would do this regardless. I'm doing this for me, not necessarily for everybody else. This is something that's always going to be going. And like what you said, like, I feel like you really touched on that same thing, which is, it makes me feel good to hear, because mm-hmm. you know, you're not alone in a situation of having to keep your mind busy. Excuse me. So when it comes to building the decoy, you, like, for me, my placement in waiting, so like, I mean, I do a lot of resin and stuff now, so I make a master out of wood, carve it, and then I pour the resin. But the weighting is still the same, which is, it's almost, depending on what kind of bait I'm doing, I almost want to throw it off balance. The more off balance, like, you want it to be like sit properly in the water column, but if I throw the weight off balance a little bit, that's what throws the body around a little bit. There's very specific places to put the weighting, but for you, your weighting would be much different, because that's what I don't understand. Because if you have it coming down the hole and spinning in a large circle,
mm-hmm.
if you just weighted it center,
mm-hmm.
I would think it would just fall like a brick right it down would. To the bottom. So it's got to be a very specific weighting system.
It is
that you guys do.
Yeah, and if you're getting into making decoys, it's one of the things. I know, I remember myself too, but talking to new carvers, they're like, how do you bait a decoy? And it's, in our decoy world, we have a group of people that hang out a lot, and we do shows where they have contests and everything. And so there's gotten to be kind of a perfect swim, which when you're dealing with fish, they don't care a lot of times. Okay. But for people, they want to see a certain swim. And that certain swim is that when you put that decoy in the water, it's its level. And then when you drop it down, it goes head forward down, gliding. And when you pull up on that string, it either goes flat, in a flat circle, or maybe you pull it up a little bit and it comes down in the hole. And then some people like it really, really slow. Some people like a fast retrieve. I'm kind of probably in the middle of all that somewhere. But I try to take a lot of pride in making my decoys swim smooth. It doesn't always happen, but for the most part, I feel like they swim all pretty much the same, and it doesn't matter what I'm making, and I make a lot of decoys that probably aren't practical sometimes, but I want to make sure they all swim. They all sink. They all go in a circle. Even on the pieces where I'm just kind of going out of the box and doing something that probably isn't practical for ice fishing, but
right.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's, yep. Go ahead.
Just, you know, waiting in itself, it's time. It's, you know, I remember asking the guy that I kind of latched onto when I first started doing it. I just had to ask him, like, what do you do? And he's finally just sat down and told me, he's like, you just got to keep making them and you will figure it out. And that's exactly, I've made somewhere around a little over 2,000 decoys now, because I've been doing it for 21 wow. and a half years or so. So I make about 100 a year on average. And it really is, it's muscle memory and just knowing your wood. Like, obviously, right. if I'm using oak or something else, I'm not putting as much lead in it.
Right.
You know, it's all of the wood. You have to kind of have a knowledge of and the feel of how heavy is this wood, how light is this wood. And then, you know, when you're dealing with different types of baits or lures, just like you run out of room for lead. So you got to be really, or places to put it. So you got to be really
strategic. You got to
think a little bit about it. So.
Right. Yeah, there's some strategy when it comes to moving mm-hmm. around weighting placements. Definitely, like you said, the size of the lure itself. Because that's the other thing is, I mean, I'm not 100% sure on how big the decoys actually are, like, in hand. I'm assuming they're a decent size, because, like, when I look at pictures and stuff like that, mm-hmm. they all look, like, fairly good size. But that's a big piece of lumber that you have to make swim, right? Like, right. It's tough when you have that much weight that you, because the displacement of that weight is very easy when you have that much, like that. Because right. for me, if I have a little piece of wood, if I got a little 6-inch bait, the amount of weight that I need is not, like, if I'm making it out of wood, the amount of weight to make that sink is not going to be tons. Like, I have a right. very small threshold, where your threshold with the more wood, the more buoyancy, like, that threshold is going to be different. All things that this is where I nerd out. I nerd out at, like, nuances and the dirty details of doing things. So that's what, I mean, again, it intrigues me. Now, all of your decoys, or most of your decoys, have some type of fin, and I'm assuming those are all to help with the movement, but yeah. are they traditionally made out of aluminum? Like, is that what, because that's what I see when I see most decoys, is there's some type of aluminum or metallic. Is that common?
Yeah. Some people make them out of wood. Then you're just adding more buoyancy. But so spearing is in Minnesota anyway, I think in Michigan, Wisconsin, has a pretty long history. And as long, I mean, as, you know, 120 some years ago, they were spearing, and I think they learned from the Native Americans, is what they say, and they were just using bone. But what they were using back then, it was Depression time, so they were using cans, whatever they could find metal wise to use for fins. They were taking probably 2x4s and just whittling something that looked like a fish. It wasn't pretty like we try to do now for the right. most part. And then slapping on some paint that they thought would attract a fish. And nowadays, you know, people want to dress them up a little bit more. They want it. You're not necessarily trying to catch the fish to have someone buy it. You're trying to catch the person, you know. And
right.
if it's appealing to the person, then they'll use it. So yeah, a lot of guys use aluminum around here. I use copper, and the only reason, well. One of the main reasons why is because I hate painting fins. I don't like painting straight lines and stuff like that. And the other reason is because I like copper. I love copper, leather, and wood, and yeah. the patina they all get when you have them. But so that's kind of why I use copper. And there's some decoys we make that we don't put a lot of fins on. There's like a friend of mine kind of, I don't know if you say invented it, but he kind of made this wiggle fish, and he was a lure guy originally and started making decoys. And that, the eyelet or the where you tie the line is on the side of the fish. And you don't put a lot of fins on it because you want it to rock in the water. You want it to kind of rock back and forth or spin around in a circle, not in a circle like a decoy, but like you want that fish to do a complete 360 and then rock down. And that only has maybe a fin or two at the most on it. Otherwise, it's just a piece of wood without hook, you know, or a lure without hooks that you're just using down in the hole. But
So now to the actual decoy. So I'm assuming it's mainly pike that you're targeting.
Yes. In Minnesota, you can spear rough fish, which pike, white fish, suckers, bullheads, I believe. There might be a couple others on there. You can't spear bait, game fish like walleyes or perch. Now, I think there's like 6 or 7 states in the United States where you can spear. There's a few of them where you can spear walleyes. North Dakota just opened up their season for walleyes. South Dakota, I think you can spear almost anything. But in Minnesota, where I live, the main two targets that we hit are northern pike and then whitefish. There's not a lot of lakes that have them, but there's a few. And I actually prefer spearing whitefish. And that's a different kind of decoy for them. You're using as small a decoy as you can make, which is very difficult. Because you're looking at like an inch or two, maybe.
Wow.
And to try to get that thing weighted right, it's nearly impossible. But,
That's super interesting, though, because I always took it as like a predatorial attractant for pike, right? Like they just see something and they're going to come in to investigate. But whitefish, like you basically need a lure to catch them. You're essentially using a lure-sized decoy.
Yep.
So what prevents you from putting a couple hooks on that decoy?
You can.
Do they not hit it? Or
you can put a hook on a decoy. So in Minnesota, the law is that you can have two lines down the hole at one time. Your spear is considered a line. And so you can technically have a decoy down with a hook on it. That's considered a hook, I guess.
Right.
So your spear is a hook, and your lure can have hooks on it. They used to make them back in the day and call them cheater fish. And that law got changed here maybe 5 years ago. Maybe it's more than that, where you could actually put a hook on a decoy. Otherwise, it was illegal before. But I don't put a hook on there just because I don't want to deal with small pike biting my baits all the time. Because technically, if they're in your hole, it's kind of weird. Okay, so I kind of want to step back. But like for spearing, you know, it can have a bad name because I think a lot of people think that guys are going out and spearing everything they see. Obviously, we have the same bag limits as anybody else.
Right.
And there, you will find guys that will go out and spear, you know, big pike all the time. And when you see those in pictures, it kind of puts a bad name on spearing because, you know, the thing to do now is to throw fish back. And I respect anybody who wants to keep a fish and eat it. I don't care, you know, if that's what you want to take. The nice thing about spearing is you can pick. You don't have to hook that fish.
Yes.
You can let it go. And I do that. I think last year I speared maybe 3 fish. And I saw I bet you I saw close to 100 on, you know, where I go. And so, you know, we're trying to give the sport a little bit better name too, just by educating people and saying, you know, spear what you're going to eat and maybe let some of the fish pass that you know, if you don't really need to have a meal that day or whatever, but, it's conservation, just like any other sport. You know, you see it in deer hunting, you see it in fishing, anything. And so it's just another avenue.
Right.
So,
proper education on the sport itself. And I that's super important because I think that goes across it goes across everything. It's just more education for what we do, whether it's regular fishing or spear. Like I said, I know nothing about the spear fishing. So that's because I'm of that person that sees it and just be like, they're all just smashing monster pike every time they go out there. Like, is that, I don't know how sustainable that is, but
right.
But you're right. Yep. Like that might just be, that could also just be their one time out. You know what I mean? They mm-hmm. get that one fish or whatever, but that has a lot of ties with, like you said, the hunting community is mm-hmm. letting something pass right. with the hopes of getting the one that you want. Like not just taking the first thing you see, but getting the one you want, mm-hmm. which is, I think, a big point to put through. So you said that you had maybe three spears last season.
Mm-hmm.
What is now that's, I'm assuming that's your choice and all mm-hmm. that stuff, but a fish comes in the hole and it's the one you want.
Yeah.
What would you say your success rate on average of getting the fish you want? Like it's in the hole. That's the fish you want. Like, I mean, how hard it is what I'm getting at, to actually slowly put that spear in the water from what I see and then actually getting that fish.
For someone who knows what they're doing, I'd say, especially early in the season when you can get them to come in, you're probably looking at, you know, 70 to 90% success rate for most people.
That's right.
Later in the year, they don't want to come in totally in the hole. You'll see their head. And I mean, we're dealing with big holes here. So like you can see way under the water. You'll right. see a head under the water, but they'll just stay back there. And so as far as throwing a spear success rate, I don't usually typically throw a spear anymore because I've learned through time that it's just not worth it. It's just like shooting a deer when it's 600 yards out. Do you really want to take right. that shot?
Right.
And I don't like wounding fish. I mean, I've had a fish come off before and it makes me sick to my stomach, you know, cause it's mm-hmm. like, well, there's probably a dead fish now, you know,
for sure
that we can't take. And, so my success rate's probably a little higher, just because of my experience. And you get a young kid out there, he's not going to know any better, you know, and
right.
and maybe not know exactly how to do it. You know, you want to kind of hide that spear from the fish. They're not usually seeing it anyway because it's above them, but there's times where they might see it coming because they're looking at you sometimes if they come from the front of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
And they will move. You know, I've had them move at the last second and they get away.
It's about that trigger discipline.
Whitefish, on the other hand, we kind of name them water ninjas because they come in and by the time you see them, they're already going out of the hole. And so you have to be ready at all times for them. And that is why I enjoy that a little more, because it's not just throwing a spear for the most part straight down the hole. You're on edge of your seat waiting for them to come in and you got to be ready to throw that spear.
Now, how deep are you when, like, on, I know lakes are different depths, so I know that's a loaded question, but is there like, no, we're not doing it in 30 feet of water? Or is it like only in 8 feet? You know what I mean? Is there like a honey spot that you guys try to go for?
I think it's a lot like summer fishing in a way, because early on in the season, you're going to want to be a little shallower. You're going to want to be, I mean, I know people that spear in 3 feet of water. I typically don't do that, but my kind of sweet spot is somewhere between 6 to 8 feet. Later in the year, the pike seem to kind of move out. And so I've speared in 20 feet of water. I know guys that have speared in deeper water than that. The only problem with that is it's harder to spear fish when you have 30 feet of water underneath you. So they're coming up and they're seeing you a little bit more. So a lot of guys concentrate in bays, in channels, you know, kind of like when you're hunting, you're concentrating on pinch points and, you know, just areas where, you know, pike are going to be, they're going to be eating, trying to get, you know, in the bays, at least early on in the season, they're in the bays right. trying to feed. So,
well, that's, the water refractory or whatever it's called. Yep. I don't remember, like, mm-hmm. if you're in that deep of water too, like if you're outside of the range of your spear,
right.
To my assumptions, like when you put the spear in the water, you're going to see the refractory or whatever it's called, yep. and you're going to be able to see that. But if you now need to go further than the length of your spear, then that just throws again, this is me just trying to visualize it right now. Like that's got to be Now, I'm assuming the spear is tethered to a rope or something, like, mm-hmm. just in case you drop it. But generally speaking, for the most part, because you're in 6 to 8 feet, that spear doesn't leave your hand. Or does it? Like, do you actually push it through the water and then retrieve the spear? Yeah. Or is it something more like a pitchfork motion, like where you just stab it and pull it out?
I've had fish come in where you don't let go of the spear. That's in usually in shallower water or right under the ice. I mean, there's times where they've come in and yeah, you're not letting go of the spear, but I'd say I probably throw the spear under the water way, way more than I spear fish with a spear in my hand. And a lot of people ask, well, how hard do you throw the spear? You're not throwing it. You're kind of like you're shooting pool. You're just kind of giving it a nudge. Unless you're like thrown in a corner where you're trying to get a fish, but for the most part, it's just kind of a nudge because you're letting that weight of that spear do a lot of the work.
Right.
And if you have a sharp spear with really good barbs on it, it's going to go through the fish and it's not going to come off of them.
Like, are the spears generally fairly heavy? Like 15 pounds, 10 pounds?
Yeah, I should know this. I'd say they're probably somewhere between 5 to 10 pounds. You know, there's a lot of spear makers out there.
Yeah, for sure.
Some make them really heavy. The spears I have used most of my life are old blacksmith spears that were made, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago. And they're a little lighter, but they were made that way to throw at like whitefish and tulipy so that you could kind of throw in corners of your hole. And so it's all a matter of preference. You want a spear that just drops straight down and you know it's going to go through that fish and you don't have to worry about it. Or do you want something a little bit more agile that you can kind of go after a fish a little bit more?
Now, like I in the, like when I had the opportunity to do some sight fishing for, like I did some for crappie, but it's sometimes for perch, depending if it's the season. But being able to sight fish is so much fun, like in a boat, like for me in the summer. Now, you're essentially 100% sight fishing. That's what you're doing. So that automatically triggers something within me because you're sight fishing. But with that being said, I'm not like me, I'm by shores. I'm shallower. I can see them. You're, like you said, potentially from 6 to 20 feet of water. It depends. It's pitch black where you are, so you can, and I've seen the pictures of the hole and it just never makes sense how clear the water looks and when the fish come in. But with that being said, what's the, like, you've been doing this for so long, is there something that's really like came through that hole where you're like, I didn't even think I'd see one of those, like, you know what I mean, like,
yeah,
a species of fish where like a sturgeon comes swimming through or something, like, has there ever been something come through the hole where you're like, I can't believe I got the opportunity to see this?
Well, it's amazing what you will see in that hole. I was fishing or spearing up kind of on the border of Canada there with my brother-in-law, and he had an otter come in his hole. Scared the crap out of him. I heard him screaming, and he was like 100 yards away. Muskrats, you see a lot of them. They'll even come up and sit on your spear if they don't know you're in there because they can't see you. No.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I've seen turtles, I've seen frogs. See pike go down and dig for frogs once in a while because they go down in the mud and hibernate. And you'll see mud on top of the pike beak, you know. And
really?
Yep. I've seen pike essentially sleep on the bottom of the lake. They sit down there and they don't move for hours. I'm trying to think if I've seen any crazy fish. I mean, it's crazy the size fish that you will see. I've seen 8 to 10 pound walleyes go through my hole.
Wow.
Crappies as big as a, you know, 12 inch frying pan. It's just, that is the most fun I get out of spearing out there, seeing things like that. Cause it's, you don't know what's under there, you know, unless you're scuba diving, you know, or snorkeling or something.
Right. Well, you literally have a window into their world.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't have any other time to be able to just sit there because there's no, like, it's not like you're sitting in waves or anything like that. You just have a perfect image of what they have. And that's, I mean, that I agree. I think that would be, it's also, again, I can assimilate it to hunting because it is so much, you are hunting, you're fish hunting. And it's the same thing when I would sit in a stand or if I was in the bush and I would go a whole day and not see anything, like as far as what I was hunting. But you would have wildlife all over you. And you're just like, this happens every day when I'm not here. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's that wonderment of like, this world exists while I'm out in the, you know, the concrete prison doing my day to day. This world still exists and this does this. And these animals will get eaten and will get killed and will fight and they'll breed and they'll mate. And that, like, this is a world that exists symbiotic to what we're doing. And like, to look down at a fishing hole where I spend summers guessing, throwing baits and trying to make educated guesses on where they are. You're looking down into that world and you're seeing that life. And that would have me so in awe that the second that trigger fish that you do want comes into view, then your adrenaline's already at,
oh yeah,
your adrenaline's already at 100.
Yeah. You know, I've seen a fair amount of 40 plus inch northerns or 40 inch northerns come through my hole, or, you know, 36, whatever. And when you see that fish come in the hole, whether I'm spearing it or not, and a lot of times I'll watch them, but, it is, you get buck fever, your hands start shaking. It is, no it's doubt. An amazing thing to see a fish that big in the water. And we have muskie down here too, and I haven't seen many muskie, but you know, you're looking at 50 plus inch fish for some people that see them come through the hole.
Wow.
That is a monster. And then, you know, go over to Wisconsin, they spear sturgeon. They don't have a spearing season other than sturgeon. And then you're looking at 100, you know, 100 inch fish or more. And I can't imagine. That's, I want to do that one day, go over to Wisconsin and spear, or at least sit in the house with somebody and be part of that. But, you know, I think it all boils down to a respect for what you're going after.
Right.
You know, whether it's deer or turkeys or fish, you respect that animal. You respect the life that you're taking, and you appreciate it. You know, I appreciate those fish. I love watching them. I love learning what they do when I do this or do that.
Right.
And so it just, it's all of those things above. And I know a lot of people, you know, you think of spearing, well, you're just going out killing fish. It's not even just that. It's just like when you're fishing, you're not just going out there to pull fish in the boat. You're there for the whole experience, and
right,
the whole experience is what brings me there.
Right.
You know, and then the people you hang out with, if you have people you go with, that's the other added bonus, whether it's family. And I take my two boys out. They're nine now and six, and they've been going out since they're around three. I think I started taking them out. A lot of people think that's really dangerous, and it can be, but, you know, I show them respect for the water and the ice. And, you know, I know my kids now, if they were out on an icy lake, they know what they have to do. But watching kids learn it and grab onto that is really amazing. It gets them away from TV. It gets them away from the iPad. If you know, and it gets them out in the outdoors, and they love it. They love it more than I do. They're begging me to go out, you know, every day during spearing season. And it's really nice to see that.
That, I mean, and that is, I couldn't agree more to that. It's, I think as a parent too, that's, because we always talk about bettering the further generation. I'm not even talking about my kids. It's just, I want there to be sustainable fishing. I want there to be sustainable hunting. Like, I want these things to not end in my generation, like awareness and education to put out there so that we can keep it sustainable. But once I had my kids, like, it's, as a parent, the act of passing something down, and it's not, it's just like change, like every, you know what I mean? Like teaching your kid how to change a tire on a car, like things that they should know to grow up. I also feel like knowing how to rig a line up, and to fish or to hunt or to do these things. And I mean, I'm not saying that I've taught my kid all of these things, but I've shown them all how to fish. They love fishing. And when they pick it up, it's just, there's almost a visceral feeling. It's just something we're supposed to do
right.
as parents, is to pass down these pieces of knowledge for them to take and be successful. And when it comes to outdoors things, it fires me up. And I agree with the same thing. Like when they want to go fishing, Dad, can we go out on the boat today? Instead of, can I play Roblox or whatever they're playing on their tablet? It's hard to say no to that. It's hard to say no to let's get into nature and do something that's totally awesome. Right. And I mean, yours is the winter months, mine's the summer months, but that's, to get back onto what you were saying about people spearing, well, first of all, sturgeon, which up here, you're not even allowed to take them out of the water when you catch them. Like you have to unhook it in the water, free release. Like they are sacred up here. So to hear the people spear them, it's just like, I'd like to see one. Never mind right. spear one. Like they're dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But pike, knowing that that's what I would say from what I've seen. Like I've never seen videos of people spearing whitefish. Mm-hmm. I've only ever really seen people spear pike from the limited amount of videos that I've watched. Like it's not like I've super deep dived yeah. on it. But up here, you talk to people and pike are, a lot of people will say pike are too fishy. Pike are slimy. They're gross. Pike is probably in my top three of freshwater fish to eat. Like I love pike. Is that a normal table fare, more normal table fare down there? Like, is it not crazy to say you're eating pike?
No. In Minnesota, walleye is kind of the state fish.
Yes.
It's kind of the fish that everyone wants to eat. And I'm the same as you. Like walleye is probably down on 3 or 4 on my list because it doesn't have a taste at all. It's just
right.
the batter is what makes that taste good. It's
exactly.
So white. Crappie and sunfish and northern are kind of my top fish I like to eat. And especially in the winter or early spring when that water's cold, that fishiness for the most part is gone. It's to me, it tastes better than a walleye. It doesn't have a fishy taste. It's just got a flavor and they do smell, when you're filleting them, but it doesn't transfer into the meat in the winter like it does in the summer when it's hot and muggy and, they're down in the mud and stuff like that. Like bass, but yeah, it's, if someone says, hey, we're having a pike fry tonight or we're having some pike, no one would bat an eye up, in Minnesota about it because pike are really prevalent here for the
right.
most part. They're in every lake. A lot of guys you talk to, they're like, you spear, you either get two responses, you spear or you spear. Great. You're taking out the walleye eaters and the sunfish eaters,
Right. Right. You're doing a service for the summer guys.
Yeah.
No, because that's my response. If it was I'm having pike, they'd be like pike. Like you would get this oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. People, because they say it's too bony or it's too, mm-hmm. but a lot of it is almost passed down adage. To me, for sure they're bony, but if you know how to clean them, just like anything right. else. And to me, it is, you explained it really well. Walleye is walleye. Like it's sure. It's great. If you have a bunch of people over, you can get some nice fillets out of them. It's a clean fish. But like you said, it just tastes, walleye's great transfer of a good batter, whatever you're using. But to me, pike doesn't have, I would never say a fishy taste, but a little bit of butter and lemon or mm-hmm. a very simple coating on it. I don't know. I've always found it so good. So when I watch that, I'm just like, oh, you could catch decent table fare doing this. And I love it because also the amount of meat on the flanks of even the back of a 14 inch pike, 18 inch pike, Like it's a fantastic table fare. Mm. Like that's a great eating fish. So it's just, it's not as common up here. Most people are like, no, there's no way. I would never eat a pike. But it's also the habitat. Like you said, they're living in like the weedy, scummier areas. As the summer goes on, and just they have a reputation up here. So in the winter, it would be, I'd like to try the difference between ice pike mm-hmm. over.
Yeah, over I'd say it's, pike. For me, I don't keep northerns in the summer if I catch them. But in the winters when I keep the majority of the fish, or early spring if I'm fishing and the water's cold, I'll keep fish. But I'm also not a real big fan of frozen fish, so I'm really weird that way. If I'm going to, if the wife says, hey, can we get some fish for supper tonight? That's when I spear some fish or catch right. some fish in the summer. We're not big fans of like throwing them in a baggie and freezing them and then eating them later. I just think you lose so much of that good flavor.
You definitely do. And I mean, throughout the summer, I'm the same way. Like the species changes as the summer goes on. And we try to, like, if I'm going fishing today, leave a spot open for a fish fry tonight. Right. Like we're eating what I catch today. The only time that changes is later, like as the season gets colder, like right now, it's kind of iced over now, but maybe a month ago, I would go perch fishing, like cold water perch fishing, and I would limit out and I would freeze that. I would freeze mm-hmm. a lot of that. And that's just because when I do have an urge for fish and it's colder and I'm not doing fishing when it's colder, I like to have the fish that I caught. I don't necessarily want to go to the grocery store and buy something that who knows how long it's been there. I like to know kind of source my fish, and it's just my own thing. It doesn't mean I won't do the grocery store option. It's just if I have the option to do something I caught, I feel like, I don't know, it just makes you, it's my own thing. I just like the thought of me catching it and having it. So I generally don't like to have that, but in the cold months, like in the winter, I do try to not stockpile, but it'll be enough for like maybe a meal, maybe two, just so that I know the source of my food. Right. And then once that's out, then it's going to the grocery store and getting what we need. But that's basically the only time during the summer if I'm eating, generally speaking, my favorite would be to clean it on the boat and then have it on the shore like minutes later. That's generally speaking what I like to do. If I'm getting a cottage or something, I'm trying to eat that fish, like as soon as I've dispatched it. When it comes to spearing through the hole and you're taking that fish out, I guess because it's winter, you can just kind of throw that outside of your hut. It'll freeze on you, right? Like you don't have to worry about preservation of it.
Right. And the only, I guess, drawback is that you're freezing it if you throw it out and you're going to be there all day. Mm. But I know a lot of guys that throw them in a burlap sack and then they stick them in the fish house with them.
Okay.
And supposedly that burlap sack will take some of the slime off them also. So
that would make sense.
Yeah. But yeah, I throw mine outside for the most part. Spear guys are, you know, it's quite a tradition, but a lot of guys hide their fish if they're spearing them or cover up the blood outside because they don't want people to know they're getting fish over there. So
that's the same in the summer, guys. Mm-hmm. Releasing this fish that they don't want at the side of the boat right. So you can't see that you've got them.
Yeah,
that's common. Now, with the disturbance in the water, like you see the fish, you get the spear in there, you hit it, you bring that fish out. With that disturbance, does that generally ward off fish for an amount of time? Like, are you now kind of waiting 20 minutes, half hour for things to settle, or have you burnt that spot now?
No. Actually it could work both ways. One thing is if you let it hit the bottom, sometimes the silt on the bottom will cloud the hole for a while. That would be maybe the only thing that would be limiting to fish coming in, or at least you seeing them. But I think just, and I don't know scientifically know this, but I think just by experience, like pike are investigators, and if they see disturbance in the water, like in the bottom of the lake, sometimes that'll bring them in. If there's blood in the water, I think they don't mind the blood in the water, and they sometimes come in to investigate that.
Right.
So I don't think it's a big deal. You might be later in the winter when they're a little bit more skittish. That might be true, where you have to wait a, 10-15 minutes. But I wish I knew how fish lived a little more, because it would help me understand, like, just, are they coming in schools? Are they, is there two or three about the same size kind of swimming around together?
Right.
I don't know enough about that to fish correctly, I think, sometimes, because pike, I feel like they do their own thing, and you can never figure them out some days. But I think the pressure systems I don't think the temperature matters so much, but I know pressure is a big deal. If you go out on, I think it's a high pressure day before a storm or whatever, you might see a few more fish.
Right.
But I know guys that have taken logs ever since they started spearing, and they have like 20, 30 years of data. I wish I would have done that, but I didn't.
I mean, I had a fish tank years ago, and I had bought, they labeled them as freshwater barracudas, and to me, they just looked like really, really small northern pike. So I don't know what they were, but I had them for quite some time, and watching there, because I said that I had feeder fish and eater fish, so I just kind of mixed the community of fish together, and the ones that didn't get eaten were survivors. So, but watching them and how they would react, and they would all go up to like where the water was moving, and they would sit in moving water dead still. Yeah. The second you turn the lights off, it would just be these like glints of light everywhere. You turn the light back on, and they'd be like tails of fish sticking out of their mouths and stuff. Like, they were opportunistic, like 100%, like apex predators. So, but I got to learn a lot about fish behavior just by this little fish tank and how they reacted with each other. But again, that's a micro ecosystem compared to what you're dealing with. To get back on the spears really quickly before we get into some of the final questions in the show, a typical decoy, I don't want to say like an average decoy, because they're all unique to themselves, but a typical decoy, how long from start to finish does that take you to make?
It's probably the most common question someone asks me, and I never have a good answer for it, because I've never sat down to record the time that it takes me to do one, because a lot of times, at least nowadays, I'm making four or five at a time. And
right.
So it's hard for me to say, well, but if I was to guess, for an average decoy, depending on the detail I put in it, and the size, I'm probably looking at 4 to 8 hours, and I should probably, I'm not necessarily a true hand carver. I use a lot of power tools. I use a bandsaw, and then I use a belt sander to kind of smooth the decoy down. And then I have a Dremel that I use sometimes. And then, one thing I think is amazing watching you and Marlene Bates and some of those guys and Solar Bates is, you guys hand carving scales. I don't think I have the patience for that. So I have a wood burning tool that I use,
which is genius.
And it's okay. It's not the detail you would get, because you can't adjust the size. I mean, I have like 3 or 4 sizes, but you can't size it according to the fish you're making. But so I have so much respect for people that can sit down and hand carve a fish all the way through. But I can do things a little quicker. And I'd say my decoys are, in the decoy world, there's your basic decoy for just people are throwing them in the water. They're not probably taking care of them. They're just, they're a tool. And then you have where I think I fit in is it's a working decorative decoy. So some people that buy, a lot of people that buy my decoys, put them on the shelf, you know, in their house right. or whatever. But then there's some people that use them. And then you have your upper echelon carvers who are carving almost taxidermy type fish. I doubt their fish ever hit the water. Right. But they are for collectors and people that are just going to be putting them in their cabin. So, you know, the time I put in my decoys isn't going to be as much as them, but mine are geared more towards working for using. And that's right. why I make them out of cedar. I hate cedar, quite honestly, working with it. Like you said, it can be brittle. It's hard to carve hand-wise. But it stands up in the water, and that's what I like about it, is that right. you can use my decoys for years, and they're not going to fall apart on you. Right. I started using that thick clear coat that you put on a rotisserie, which is kind of difficult with bigger lures because you're dealing with a lot of weight there. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it gives it a little bit more protection, and then it also pops those colors out.
Yes.
You know, I paint a fish and I think, oh, this looks like crap. And then I stick a clear coat on it and it's amazing what that thing can do, you know.
It does. It just enriches everything. Yep. If that's what you're going for too.
Yeah.
That's a part of my problem as well. It's like, I'll try to get a very realistic, which is a little more matte. So I'm looking into different matte finishes, but matte finishes also don't come in like a thick two-part epoxy, sure. which can take when you're dealing with the toothy guys, that's mm-hmm. when you need it's tough to have a thin clear coat because they'll just shred everything mm-hmm. that you got going in the water. Again, I've got a couple questions to ask them on every podcast. They're going to pertain a little different. What do you do for summer? Do you fish summer? Like, or is that just your, are you strictly
on a lake.
Dark? Get out of here.
I don't have an excuse to not fish, but honestly, I don't fish as much as I thought I would. And I know I used to kind of cuss people out that lived on lakes that never fished, but, on the lake I live on, there's every type of freshwater fish for the most part. I mean, you got perch and bass and northerns and walleyes, crappies and sunfish. And I fish a lot in the spring when the fish are feeding. When I have to go hunting for them, my fishing kind of dies down, and that's developed over years where I've focused more of my energy on spearing. And maybe not as much on my summer fishing. I used to go up to Canada with my dad and some friends. When I was in high school, we'd go up to Reed Lake, and I can't remember what province that's in, but it's up by the pass, the Flin Flon. I want to say Manitoba, but
okay,
it might be Saskatchewan.
Well, you're right. Yeah, you're right below that. Yeah, that's Saskatchewan, I believe. You guys are right below Saskatchewan.
So we used to go fishing for walleyes and northerns up there, and I enjoy fishing. It's not that. It's just the time now. Right. My kids are begging to fish a lot, so then I do, for the most part, I'm out there setting up their hooks, and, you know, they're breaking lines, so I'm putting stuff on them for them. But I enjoy being on the water. I love the water. I love the lake. And so my enjoyment of fishing in the summer is more that aspect. Don't get me wrong. I like catching fish. It's just, it's not my main focus anymore.
Right. Right. So as far as the series of questions that go, I got a new one that I'm going to ask you. The first person I'm asking this, because it was actually asked to me on one of the Instagram lives I do. And it's something that I've milled around. And I thought for makers, it's a good question because it also opens up awareness. You said you've been doing this around 20 years. What is, in your opinion, the worst accident you've had making baits? Have you had one?
I've been pretty fortunate. I'm very careful. But I have had a close call with the bandsaw once where I felt it on my skin, which gives me the quivers every time.
Oh, dude, you saying it makes it. I know.
But I think the for me with power carving, obviously the belt sander, my knuckles get wore down many, you know, almost every time I do it, it seems like, or my nails, you know, that's another feeling I hate. But when I do carve with a knife and I'm putting fins in or something, I have poked my hand pretty bad and cut, you know, into the meat of my palm. That's probably the worst cut I've had, or
that's
injury.
I mean, that's when it was asked to me, I almost felt like a fraud by saying that, like, my injuries are minor. Like, they're not, I don't have any, like, juicy stories on injuries. But I'm very sane. I come from a construction background, so, like, PP is always forced on you on the trade. So that was easy for me to adopt. And I said on my live, unfortunately, I already know that my injury is going to come in 30 years from now because latency, because my biggest problem is, like, respiratory PPE, like masks and stuff like that. I should wear them way more. I wear them for the most part, but there's times where I don't, and there's times where I slip, and I know that that's going to be an issue for me. It's like a long-term respiratory illness because of that. But as far as like cuts or severs or ligament damage, I've been pretty fortunate as far as it's gone injury-wise. So I think that's a testament to the fact that nicks and scrapes and like wear and tear over 20 years of doing this is pretty impressive to what you over 1,000 baits. Good for you. I think that's good for people to hear that.
Yeah. And I, you know, I work with cedar and I have a fair amount of an allergy to it if I in it enough, especially sanding it. And I don't, like you, I don't wear masks like I probably should. I try to do a lot of it outdoors or in a big area, where the sand, you know, the sawdust isn't going right up into my face. Right. I do a lot of my sanding outside my carving shack, and but I'm really bad at wearing masks when I should. and I agree. I think if I'm going to have an injury, it's going to be down the road. I have a friend, I guess, that I just met at the decoy show I was at, and I'd known him for years, but he's an older gentleman and he's having respiratory issues right now. And he's probably in his late 60s, I suppose. And, I'm assuming he's attributing it to carving. He's carved a lot of decoys. He may have been a smoker. I don't know, but he's on oxygen now. And, he says that he's worked with a lot of he works with a lot of exotic woods and stuff like that. And so, you just never know what you're breathing in.
But even like vapors from staining or sealers or paints and clear coats, like all those things are just little ticks on the tree of respiratory illness. So, I mean, wear your masks, people. Wear your personal protection when you can. I honestly do try to wear it as much as possible. It's my problem is like for lives and stuff like that. Yeah. It's hard to talk to people when your face is covered with, so I take it off for stuff like that. And I know I shouldn't, it is what it is, but well, that's good. 20 years, not too many injuries. What about now? I was going to ask you boat snacks. I always ask boat snacks, but you're more focused about the dark house. So I'm assuming like you're not bringing snacks in there, or I guess you could, because then they can't see you.
Yeah. It's the nice thing about spearing. You don't have to be quiet. I mean, other than pounding, any vibration, you don't want a vibration, but like I've had a radio in there, and you can talk, which for my kids is really good. Cause when I take them out hunting, I'm always telling them to be quiet.
Right.
But usually we'll bring, jerky is, I usually try to make some jerky out of my deer. We usually bring that out. My snacks revolve around my kids, so it's, you know, easy stuff like sandwiches and chips usually. I'm not a big candy bar eater or anything, so yeah. It'd probably be easy grabbing food, because it never fails. You go to reach down to grab something to snack, and then there's a fish tail moving out of the hole and you're like, just missed that one. But
I mean, jerky's the go-to. You have to have jerky on. Any kind of preserved meat I think is important to have. Yeah. Now, I know you're into ice fishing and time restraints you from summer fishing, but I always ask, if you had 24 hours all paid anywhere you want to go in the world for 3 bucket list fish, what would your bucket list fish be?
I think going to Alaska and fishing for some salmon. Alaska is kind of on my bucket list.
Nice.
I think any kind of ocean fishing would be fun, although I'm not sure if I would get seasickness, so I'd want to make sure that I knew that ahead of time, because I have been seasick up in Canada one time, but it was when I was a kid. We were out lake trout fishing and I barely made it back to shore, but so, and then one more would be, I think sturgeon fishing would be kind of fun, just to try it.
Right.
To pull one of them up.
Right. Yeah, I mean, those are all, sturgeon fishing is something that is just, like I said, up here, they're like, I've heard of people catching them. I've seen a video or two of people mm-hmm. that have caught them in places that I have fished, but they're like the Loch Ness monster. Like, yeah. You just hear about them. So when I see some of these videos of the guys pulling up these monsters, like it is a true testament of things to mm-hmm. see when you have one of the most dinosaur looking fish that I've ever seen. That would be a ton of fun.
I'm actually making a sturgeon right now for someone for Christmas, and it's kind of a challenge. I guess I've made one, but they're just so, I try to get all that detail in of all their fins and spikes, and
yeah, there's it's a challenge. Those big armor plates on them. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful, man.
Yeah.
Before we went live here, we were talking about you do a show. Did you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
Or you're a part of?
It's really not a big deal. It's I started doing I guess you could call it a podcast, although it's been mainly on Facebook. We do Facebook Lives and we sit down and talk, just because I enjoy spearing so much. And the other thing is I wanted to interview people because there's so much knowledge of older spear makers and decoy carvers that once they die, it's gone. And I kind of wanted to start doing that. And so 2 years ago we started, you know, and it wasn't anything like you're doing. It's not like a regimen thing. And it was Friday Night Pikes is what we called it.
That's awesome.
And we'd sit down on Fridays usually and do a live podcast, which I want to do it on a real podcast venue. The only problem, or not a problem, but the one thing that we would lose is the interaction with people. Like when you do your Instagram lives, it's really fun to interact with people. And yes. When you do a podcast, you can't necessarily do that. So I wish there was a way to do both. But so then we started doing that. And then I started posting it to YouTube, to my YouTube page, a few of the episodes. But it's definitely it's more for me, I think, and some of my friends that are really into it, just interviewing some of these people and doing exactly what you're doing right now, just learning different things about the carvers, because I feel like when you know the carver, and I started watching Marlene Bates here, and I'm, you know, I've made a few baits, and it's not as easy as it looks, for sure. There's a lot of things that you don't think about when you're trying to get a bait to move in the water. But I started watching him a long time ago before he even talked. And then he started talking, and the talking just amplified because you got to learn about him. And, you know, and with you doing your live Instagrams, it's not just a picture or, you know, a comment under a video. You're actually in these people's lives, and you can, you know, just bounce questions off them, ask them what makes them. And I'm a nerd like you are. I want to know everything about carving decoys or baits. And like I said, I'm not a bait maker necessarily. I like making them once in a while, but it's funny. You know, I'll watch you and I'll watch Marlene and Solar Baits, and I have a lot of the same equipment they have, but it's not like we talk about it or I go and get exactly what they have. It's just, you have the same stuff on your desk as I do. And when you're making the bait, it's like watching someone make a decoy, you know, it's just there's so much that can, that crosses over there that I find it very interesting. Yeah. So I appreciate you going kind of out of your comfort zone and interviewing a decoy carver, which you know nothing about, because I just feel like it's just another avenue that, you know, you can interview 100 bait makers, but then you have something here. Or, you know, with me, I interview spear makers and decoy makers, or fish house guys that make fish houses, or ice saw, that makes the ice saws. It's just, you just want to soak up everything, you know?
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, that's this, like this was for me. This, excuse me. This by no means, like, I love that people have taken to it and people have enjoyed listening to it, but this was my opportunity to talk to, I don't do many soft plastics. I've talked to some great soft plastics. I've talked to makers of the molds for soft plastics, like yourself, decoys. I've talked to tournament anglers. I've talked to, like, swim bait fishers. Like, mine, I'm not, even though what I do is very nuanced and in a lane, my insights and my desire to learn about all of it, there's no end to it. So for me to have the opportunity to sit down with someone like yourself, who, like you said, although they line up so much, they're two different worlds. I get to learn a whole new aspect of essentially fishing, which I love doing, bait making, which I love doing, and a community of, you have a community of decoy makers. I have a community of bait makers. I have a community of swim bait people. Like, even though they're all separate communities, when you talk to somebody, you're like, oh, your community is the same as my community. Mm-hmm. Like, we're the same. We could get together in one big room and all have a really, really fun discussion. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I'm trying to do here. And again, it's for myself, but for people listening, is to know that, like, it's such a big, even though you feel like you're in such a small group, you're part of such a big group of all like-minded thinkers. Like, I talked to Fly Fishing the Ozarks, and he does fly fishing, Brian Wise. He does flies totally, like, mm-hmm. so far away from what I do. And talking with him was like, oh, we've been best friends forever.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you just, there's so many paths that cross, and I feel the same way with you. Like, I could sit down, we're talking over the internet right now, but if I walked in a bar and you were sitting there, and I could be like, Ryan, mm-hmm. it's Brent, let me buy you a beer, and I could spend the rest of the evening doing this exact thing that we're doing right now, and just talk, right? So it's I love this about what I'm doing right now. It's big part is for me. I just love that people kind of feel the same way about it. You had said something that I just totally slipped my mind, but it had to do with, it doesn't matter. I'm never going to get it back. I'd sit there and hum and haw about it, but I'll forget about it. I promise. Or it'll never come back. But yeah, this is, I appreciate you being a part of this and sharing what you do, because if I don't know about it, I know at least five more people that don't know anything about it. And I think you did a really good job promoting something that, like you said, could be, for lack of a better term, bastardized, mm-hmm. because it's so, like, people think of the rudimentary things as barbaric. Right. Like, oh, you're using a spear through the water? Like, it's not that. It is, and I don't care what anybody says, it's also got to be difficult. Like, it's got to be hard. So I think you've done a really good job here explaining what it is that, first of all, the sport that you participate in, but what it takes to build the decoys that you do, which, again, it's Tradewell Decoys on Instagram, Friday Night Pikes. On YouTube, on Facebook, and YouTube.
It's on Facebook and Instagram. I haven't posted Instagram as far as live feeds, but I usually try to post the episodes to my YouTube page. Which, if you just search Tradewell Decoys on YouTube, I honestly don't know the address, but if you type in Tradewell Decoys on YouTube, I have thought about, you know, trying to start doing more videos on there. That's kind of why I started the page spearing videos or making baits and stuff, but I'm sure just like you are, I don't even know how you have the time to do everything you do, but you know, you just with kids and family and work, it's so hard to focus on multiple avenues at one time unless you quit your job or don't see your family anymore. And
so, it is honestly a balance of like you have to, I mean, the kids and family are always first. But then with the time that you have remaining, well, that I have remaining, I've learned now. And I mean, starting 2 ago was like planning. I have almost to the end of December booked now for podcasts. So like setting the date, making sure, doing more planning ahead, and then trying bait making now just kind of fits into the when I have times.
Right.
Because like you just, because the problem is my dreams of what I want to do are exponential. Like I have a full video portion of this, not this, but a subsect of this, where it's bait and tackle reviews that I want to do, but I want to do that on YouTube. So it's something to watch. But when do I have time for that? Do you know what I mean? Like I have these things. So it's like you said, it's just right now it's kind of categorizing time, but I think you should do it. I think that if you carve out that time, if you figure out that time, it's going to take from maybe something, but I think what you have to talk about is super interesting. So
I do have to say I have an amazing wife that supports me, so much in everything I do. I wouldn't be able to do what I do without her support and help. And she assists me a lot on, you know, editing and setting up for the podcast or, you know, just she'll even help me paint fish if I got a few that I got to get out the door. She's an awesome artist herself, but
amazing.
She just, I think people see my page but she's the big part of it. So,
that's a common theme, and I get in trouble. So you're going to get me in trouble here. I get in trouble every time because somebody always mentions how amazing their wife or their partner or their girlfriend are and how supportive they are. And my wife is the reason why I can do this stuff. Mm-hmm. Same as what you're saying. Like, and it's not even to do with what I do. It's she's never once said like, hey, can you take the kids? Mm-hmm. Like she cooks the kids dinner. She does like, she allows me to have the free time that I have to do what I'm doing without like complaints. It's not a job for her. She's happy to give me the freedom to do what I'm doing. So I have to piggyback on what you're saying. I have to take from you because I cannot have her listen to another podcast, which she doesn't listen to all of them, but I can't have her to listen to another one and have another person say how amazing their partner is and me not mention it. Babe, you're the best. You're the reason I can do this. But no, I'm sorry to take from you. I agree. Having a good support system is what, and the fact that you're able to tag team that, like some of the painting and stuff like that's awesome too. Like that you can have somebody that you're willing to, not even willing, but for some, I mean, I'm going to say willing because for some artistic ventures, you want to have your fingers in everything. Right. So the fact that she's creative artistically, that she's able to do the same thing and produce to your like model or standard, that's incredible. I love that. With that being said, I've already taken so much of your time. Speaking of your wife, it really is. And when it gets into conversation, and the problem is right now we're at the hour 20 mark, and this is when conversation starts to loosen up and starts to roll. So, but and list off just in one little summary where people can find you, where you want people to look. Do you have any trade shows or anything? We're getting into the icy season, so do you guys have shows or something coming up that you might want to?
So I make decoys and I do sell them. I'm not it's a hobby really when it comes down to it. And there's one big show in Perham. We have a National Fish Decoy Association that throws that. And then I just did one in a small town, just a few miles from my home here, that a buddy of mine that makes the ice saws put on, isaw.com. Those are the only two shows I do. Just because I can't make enough decoys to even do anymore. But a lot of my orders come through Facebook or, you know, friends of friends or whatever. So I kind of, I guess, made a decision here a few weeks ago. I've done orders. And I think at least for this coming year, I'm going to stop doing orders after the first of the year. I'm just going to make what I want to make. And if it's available, it'll, you know, it's for sale. And if you want it, you can have it. But if not, then just wait for the next one or whatever. But it gets to be such a kind of a pressure to make what somebody wants to make and have it be to their standards. And then just having that list all the time through the summer and winter and gets to kind of get on someone. So, but yeah, to answer your question, I'm on Facebook. And I'm so bad with addresses. So if you just type in Tradewell Decoys, there's no other Tradewell Decoys that I know of on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. You'll find me or Google me. I think it shows up on Google. So.
Perfect. No, and I appreciate that. Your page is, you got some, like I said, some beautiful works of art there. You also got a couple funny ones like the Joker that you posted not long ago. The Joker fish. So definitely creative. I can't say it enough. I appreciate you coming in and I think doing such a clear job of representing and being a positive representation to what your sport is in general and opening my eyes to a lot of stuff that I really didn't know. Like, and I want to do more research into the possibilities of if it's even possible to do it in Ontario. I doubt it is, but I don't know, the way the guides are written are very, very kind of blurry. So I'm going to look into that. And when I do, I know who I'm going to be ordering a decoy from. But again, I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day. And everybody, make sure you go check out Tradewell Decoys. Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode. Thank you for all of the support. As always, I say it at the end of every show, but I mean it at the end of every show. I appreciate the support and the donations. I've gotten a few more donations, anonymous donations, and I thank you all so much for that. Please continue to like, share, download the podcast. If you just listen, it means so much to me. But if you click that little download button, it helps produce numbers for me. So if you can hit the download button, I appreciate that so much. Otherwise, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. And as always, stay healthy, stay happy, and we'll see you on the water.